Well, the music is playing. I ought to get the microphone over here. Hey, microphone. Hey, everybody. How's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, Gareth Porter is going to blame Israel for forging documents implicating Iran in making nuclear weapons. Now, who do you think is right? The great Gareth Porter will be back on the show. And Gene Healy, author of The Cult of the Presidency, will be on the show. He's from the Cato Institute, and he's got a great piece about the war powers that we're running today on antiwar.com. It's actually the spotlight today on antiwar.com. So we're going to go over some legalities. You know, I don't know. These things are important. It's not that the legalities are the important part of the war. It's just that the dispensing of the legalities when it comes to war carries severe consequences for all kinds of precedents set for executive power here at home in so many ways, and just helps to undermine even the theory that law can restrain the power of these guys, which, on one hand, people ought to recognize the real truth of what the state is and what it isn't. But on the other hand, wouldn't you rather live in a society where the consensus is that the law says that there are some things that the government can't do to you? You know? I don't think we really want to throw that part out first. We'll keep the Bill of Rights and we'll keep Article 1, Section 9, and get rid of all the rest of the Constitution first, and then the restrictions. Yeah, that's my plan. Anyway, so Gene Healy will be on about the, the legalities of a lawless totalitarian world empire. You know, the U.S. government. Anyway. So that should be fun. The Ebola outbreak has now killed 70,000 Americans. Oh, wait, no, that's right. None. Anyway, so that's not a problem. It could be at some point. Guess we'll put that on the back burner for news coverage on the show today, since there are actual things that are happening instead of just sitting around anticipating bad things happening. Margley's going to be on the show tomorrow. And so Steven Zunis. Now, here's my problem with that. I wanted to talk with both of them today. Because Margulies, he wrote a thing about how he... Did you know this? Some of you guys that are older than me out there, did you guys remember? Did you know in the first place? Is it really the case that Eric Margulies was the one who broke the story about American, British, French help for Saddam's biological weapons program? Now, everybody knew that Ronald Reagan helped support Saddam's chemical and biological weapons programs. But did you know that it was our friend Eric Margulies was the one what broke the story? Well, that's what he says in his new piece. He was in Iraq in 1990 and went and during Operation Desert Shield in the run-up to the war. And that he scooped up some Brits and had them admit to him, hey, what are you guys doing here? Well, we've been helping with the biological weapons program. And now, you know what I wonder? Wow, trip me out, man. So, I ever tell you guys a story about the first time I ever seen Ron Paul on the TV and decided he was the greatest parliamentarian in the history of the world? So, I'd heard him on the radio before when he was running for Congress in 96. But I didn't know who he was. I didn't know his reputation. I didn't know really anything about him. He was just some Republican running for Congress. I don't know. And I don't remember him saying anything really important at the time. What I heard from him on the radio, on talk radio in Austin in 96, that's all I'm saying. I don't mean overall in that whole campaign. But anyway, as soon as he came back to Congress, I mean, it was the spring of 1997. Middle of the night, I was watching C-SPAN, and they played a rerun of Ron Paul speaking to basically empty House of Representatives. You know how these things go. And... And he says, Mr. Speaker, I have here in my hand from the British press proof that the Bush administration has been selling biological and chemical weapons and whatever precursors and details and subtleties he mixed in his statement to Iraq during the run-up to the war, during Operation Desert Shield, up to just a few weeks before the beginning of the attack in January 1991. And I said, holy crap, I can't believe a congressman just in effect accused George H.W. Bush of capital T treason on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives. And you know how Ron Paul is. He never gets mad or anything. He's just like, he's basically kind of ironic about it. Mr. Speaker, did you see the news in Britain today that, you know, they caught him red-handed with this stuff? Yeah. It's not like he's ranting and raving and demanding action or anything. He's just, hey, everybody, look. And I thought, wow, what a cool congressman. And then at the bottom of the screen, it said, Ron Paul, R, Texas. And now, many of you know, most of you, I guess, know that George H.W. Bush is a pseudo-Texan, right? He came to Texas after college to make his way in the oil business and this and that kind of thing. And that's why his boy, even though he was also born in Connecticut, is considered a pseudo-Texan as well. And of course, he was vice president for 8 years, president for had no problem carrying Texas in 1988. So here's Ron Paul accusing and Ron Paul's from Pennsylvania. You know, he'd been living in Texas about as long as George H.W. Bush, I guess. So here are two guys who are nominally Texans from the same party, and where Bush had been the president of the United States. And Ron Paul's like, hey, look, whatever, man. Truth's the truth. I'm going to go talk about it on the House floor. Blam. That was how I first ever heard Connecticut trash. Yeah, the Bushes. They're the scum of the blue blood movement. They're the lowest allowed in the skull and bones back in that generation. No, I don't know. Anyway, so wait. Now I was going to tell a story about Ron Paul and the things. Let's see. Oh, Fitzy says Saddam is still selling oil on the international market right up until the day the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. Yeah, that's true. That was after the oil for food deal. For a while, they wouldn't even let him at all. But anyway, so let's see. What was I going to say? Ron Paul and selling biological and chemical weapons. Oh, yeah, Mark Gleason and the biological and chemical weapons. So now I wonder, when Ron Paul was saying, hey, check out this scoop about the biological and the chemical weapons, I wonder if he had been referring at all to Eric Margley's work. Although, no, I guess it's 6 years later, and he's talking about a new report that had come out 6 years later. So, no, I guess not. Anyway, so that was kind of a non sequitur. Sorry. It's still about selling chemical and biological weapons to Saddam, which is important. And, you know, I can't remember what it was that I was reading the other day where a guy said he gave a speech to some kids at a college, and he realized, I know, I used to be way better at remembering all of my footnotes. I'm getting old. But, so he was saying that, you know, he was giving a speech to these kids, and he realized none of them were even alive when the first Gulf War happened. It's a whole other long lost era to them. Might as well be Vietnam or Korea or World War II to them or something. They don't remember it happening at all. And, of course, most of the people who remember it happening remember a bunch of lies and nonsense and a bunch of things that didn't really happen. You know, like, oh, all they did was shoot laser-guided bombs down the chimneys of really guilty Saddam Hussein government officials. Wrong. 90-something percent of the bombs they dropped were just dumb bombs, emptying the old inventories, slaughtering people, destroying their entire civilian infrastructure. Worst kind of war crimes. But anyway, so it's important to talk about this history for, you know, Ronald Reagan. That was my childhood, but hell, I'm almost 40. There are a lot of people who just have no connection to that era at all, but they need to know that history. So anyway, Margulies will be on the show tomorrow to talk a little bit about that. And Zunis on Israel-Palestine. Hey, all Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism in the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Live in La Vida Baroca by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm retweeting the great Radley Balco over there at the Washington Post right now. Think the government must convict you of a crime before it can punish you? He talks about a story where the jury acquitted these guys of conspiracy. Only of selling the coke, but not working together on it. The judge said, eh, you know what, I don't care about that. I see a conspiracy. So he went ahead and sentenced them on just the possession charge or the dealing charge as though they had been convicted on the charge that they had in fact been acquitted of. Maybe the jury believed that they were involved in a conspiracy together, but maybe they just didn't think that the prosecutor had met the test of proving that beyond a reasonable doubt. Maybe it's none of the judge's damn business what they thought. But they said no. And the judge went ahead and sentenced the guys anyway, and it's going through the courts and whatever. Balco's got a write-up. But as I just responded to him, this is what happened to the Branch Davidians, too. The government claimed that all the Branch Davidians, all of them, were guilty of murder and conspiracy to commit murder because four ATF agents were killed in their initial aggressive invasion, assault, on the Branch Davidians' property, where they began firing first, and everyone knows it's an absolute fact, and the pigs themselves, the ATF agents themselves, admit that they started shooting first at the dogs in their pen and at Koresh as he opened the front door to say, wait, there's women and children in here. And they shot him in the gut. There's no question about that, that they started it. And therefore, they had surrendered their right to live at that point. That's the law in the state of Texas and, in fact, in every state in the union, that no law enforcement officer has the right to initiate deadly force against anyone, only to defend, and that every person has just as much a right as a cop does to defend themselves from lethal violence. Of course, because this isn't the Soviet Union. This is America, where the people are born free and they create the government to be their security force and endow it with powers that they have because they're natural born free men. See, that's the theory. And so the jury, and in fact, they tried to make the case that the fact that the people were Branch Davidians at all was the conspiracy. Their theological commitment to the idea of an eventual confrontation with the forces of Satan, you know, making them have the exact same beliefs as, I don't know, not all Christians, but certainly a major proportion of evangelical Protestant Christians that, you know, end days very well could happen on their watch and they would have to choose sides, whatever. I don't know, rapture and whatever mixed up stuff. Did the Davidians not believe that the rapture would get them out of the way? No, I think they believed that they would have to go through the tribulation. Rapture was make-believe for them or came later or something. But anyway, whatever. They were just Seventh-day Adventists, break-offs. They weren't, and that's not a cult. It's just another kind of Protestantism. Maybe a little bit low social class for you, or maybe a little bit fundamentalist for you, but it's just Protestantism in America. Nothing criminal about it at all. And so the jury said no. They weren't guilty of murder, and they weren't guilty of conspiracy to commit murder. You tell me living in that house and believing what they believed about the Bible made them part of a conspiracy to kill cops? That what, they tricked the ATF into coming out there? I mean, so the case the government made was a giant pile of crap, and the jury, in fact, compromised. Because two guys on the jury loved the government so much, they just couldn't, you know the type. They just couldn't get over it. And so the other 10 members of the jury who wanted to acquit all the Branch Davidians decided that they would compromise with these two right-wing state-filleting blowhards and go ahead and convict them on the charge of using a firearm in the commission of a felony, because a couple of these guys did admit that they had used their firearms in defending themselves from the aggressive assault of the ATF. Well, the jury had acquitted them of murder. Never even mind the conspiracy part. And so, how do you convict them? The judge the judge said, okay, fine, whatever. And he went, I think on the Friday, he went ahead and sentenced them just on the gun charge. And then over the weekend, he thought better of it somehow. And on Monday, he came back and he said, you know what? If you're saying that they are guilty of using a firearm in the commission of a felony, then you're saying that they did commit that felony after all, and that you were mistaken when you acquitted them of that felony being a charge of murder. And so the judge went ahead and sentenced, I think, 9 Branch Davidians, surviving Branch Davidians, including ones who hadn't even been there that day, like Paul Fatta, who was actually the gun dealer who left on the morning of the raid with 90%+ of their firearms because he was on his way here to Austin to the gun show at the Old Best building on 290. They were in the gun business. He wasn't a criminal. He went and sold guns that day on the open market here in Austin. It wasn't an arsenal for the apocalypse. It was an inventory for their gun business. And here he left that day. Did you know this? Did the TV tell you that one of the Branch Davidians left that morning in a full-size truck with a camper shell full of guns, towing a U-Haul trailer full of guns to go to Austin to sell them all on the open market at the gun show because he wasn't a criminal at all? At all? Did they tell you that on TV? Yeah, but anyway, so he got convicted with them too. Sentenced to 9 years, 10 years in prison, something like that. Maybe 15. Because, of course, judges are just cops too. There's no such thing as a separate, independent branch of the government. You know, when the federal government persecuted Free Radio Austin, I remember sitting in that courtroom and listening to the federal judge, Sam Sparks, talk about the government this and the government that when he was talking about the prosecution, even though he was, you know, pretending to be hard on the prosecutor, who was a complete nitwit. Of course, he was doing everything she wanted. But he tried to pretend that, oh yeah, look at me, I'm not the government, I'm just a judge, I get to tell the government no, but the government, that's the executive branch. Yeah, right. He's just a cop too. They're all just cops too. There's your conspiracy charge. And for you truthers, there's your secret society. It's Congress and the presidency and the executive branch. And all the judges and all of their secret oaths, their sacred, I mean, oaths to each other, that no matter what, they will protect each other from the people. That no matter what, you have qualified sovereign immunity for any crime that you commit, for any innocent person you brutalize or kill or frame up. Judges, prosecutors, cops, they're all just cops. Presidents, congressmen, they're all just cops. They're all just here to brutalize you and steal your stuff. Occasionally they pose as your security force, you know, to try to at least give you the cognitive dissonance about it, to try to confuse you so it's not so simple that they're simply just pure criminals, the enemies of mankind, the state. But then you read Rothbard and get your head right, you know. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, to you guys. Oh, God dang it, Bobby. Welcome back to the show. I got this crown. It pokes out too much. I keep biting my cheek. I need to get it crushed. I need to call my dentist and ask him how much it'll cost to get my the very back corner of that thing crushed down. It's made out of a pretty soft metal, so I think you could probably just crush it down a little bit. Maybe round it off back there a little. so I can quit biting my cheek while I try to talk on my radio show where I talk for 3 hours a day. Even when it's my guest's turn. All right. Listen, I got to talk very important things at you about the war. But first, I got to talk about this Conversations with Bill Kristol. Guest, former Vice President Dick Cheney. The shamelessness of these guys. The fact that they are not hiding under rocks. Well, look, we already knew about their shamelessness. That's not news. The fact that they're not hiding under rocks, what does that say about us? Dick Cheney's not in an undisclosed location. He's just out walking the streets like a common criminal. Absolutely no shame. Absolutely no shame. And here's the thing about it. I read the whole thing. I admit I did not watch it. But dig it, it's 2 hours long. Bill Kristol interviewed Dick Cheney on September 30th, 2014. For 2 hours. And I got a few different things to tell you about, but here's the thing. Maybe I should just wait, because what I really want to do is get the sound bites. And what I really should have done was just watch the damn thing instead of reading it. I should have known that there would be good soundbiteable stuff in there, right? Well, so anyway, at the risk of spoiling it, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't spoil it. I should wait until I have the audio so I can go through and play the audio for you, right? So maybe that'll be tomorrow on the show. Scott's review of Bill Kristol's interview of Dick Cheney. For now, I guess I'll go ahead and ruin the most important part of it. They don't talk about the Iraq War at all. They spend 40, 50 minutes more on Gerald Ford's administration. And they don't talk about the Iraq War. They talk about the day of September 11th. Then he justifies spying and torture. And then they talk about how Al-Qaeda is all over the world now, and he names every country where they are except for Iraq and Syria, where he put them. And then it's over. They don't talk about the Iraq War, the decision to invade, weapons of mass destruction, supposed ties to Osama, justification of how the war was conducted. Not nothing. Not any part of it. And it's really something. And then at the end, it's not that they are just so fresh out of time. And listen, I know interviews can run away on you when it comes to the clock sometimes, you know? But they had so much time for other stuff. And even at the end, a whole thing about how we must have militarism for the indefinite future and all that. They had plenty of time for that. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, what? It's not that I'm surprised. It's Bill Kristol and Dick Cheney. But, you know, and I don't know. I guess, again, to some of you younger people, this is all ancient history anyway. Who cares? Right? What the hell do I have against Dan Quayle's chief of staff anyway? Well, tomorrow on the show, we'll go over some of this stuff, but it's really something else, this interview, man. I mean, there's a lot in there to talk about, but I want to have the audio for you. I want to have the audio for me from now on. But there's the big lie by omission. And, you know, I don't know, man. I shouldn't do this because, what the hell, it's, you know, personal and whatever, and it's sort of understood anyway, but I don't know, it does bear mention it, doesn't it? That, what if your kid had died in this thing? You know, remember when Martha Raddatz asked Dick Cheney, listen, man, you're doubling down the war, but the American people in a pretty big majority are against it. And his answer was, so? And he didn't say, listen, I know, it's really tough. It's a hard thing for these people. But they got to understand, their kids sign up this army to do this work, and it's important work, and we're making the best decisions that we can, and we're, you know, hell, it ain't no Gallipoli, I don't know, whatever the hell, something. He didn't say, listen, this is not a democracy, it's a republic, and I'm an elected official, and the responsibility is mine and the president's to make these decisions, and so even if we disagree with the public, we gotta do... Right, these are the pat answers. These are the rote answers. What did he say to her? So, the American people are against a war that you started. They want it over. So... But doesn't that seem kind of unfair to the people whose boys are dying over in that thing? And girls, too. Never mind all the civilians on the other side being massacred and having their entire society destroyed, for that matter. But now here, Bill Kristol, who was the Cheney of the, you know, so-called private economy anyway. He was the ringleader neocon out of official power. Interviewing Dick Cheney, who, as vice president, as everyone knows, Junior had ceded these decisions to him and the judgment calls to him, certainly in the first Bush administration, that this is the right thing to do, right, Dick? Okay, let's do it then. And that he's the one who ran the so-called parallel government, that's what Colin Powell called it, Feith's Gestapo office. He referred to the Pentagon end of it, but that's what he called it, a separate government, not parallel, a separate government inside the government, run by Dick Cheney and his network of people inside the different departments over the objections of everyone else, as best as they could, and boy, did they get it done. And now here these guys sit down for the be-all, end-all, two-hour interview, and they don't have a word to say about Iraq, not a word to say about this war that they caused, that Bill Kristol and Dick Cheney caused to happen. It's just amazing. You know? I mean, hell. So, I'm sorry, if you actually have family that died in the thing, I'm not trying to confront you with it. I'm sorry, I'm not trying to, you know. I do have respect for people's feelings and stuff like that. And that's pretty damn bad, how you must feel. I'm not trying to, like, call you out or any kind of thing like that. But I'm just saying in the general sense, I'm like, what if one had lost their kin in this war? And then Dick Cheney was, whatever, anyway. The guy who was responsible for it more than any other person. Well, not really. It was actually, ultimately, it was up to Bush Jr. to decide, not Dick Cheney. But still, second place then. And as we all know, he was the one who ran the entire op, you know, which is really what it was, out of the vice president's office to get us into that war, hell or high water. And it just seems like, you know, I don't know, what are we talking about? Dick Cheney and Bill Kristol have no shame. Yeah, thanks, Scott Horton, for the news flash and everything, but... Yeah, but aren't they supposed to be intelligent enough to feign shame a little? To feign enough shame to even deem the war worthy of their slightest mention? In a 2 hour, your entire career interview? In the same interview, I'll ruin one more for you. This is me not covering the interview. This is me telling y'all, wait. Spent the whole segment on it. He also says the person most impacted by 9/11 was him. Most affected. Never mind any of the dead or their survivors, children who lost their fathers. No, it was him, because he had to go to the bunker. He's afraid. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Here in a few minutes, Gareth Porter's going to be on to talk about the Israelis trying to forge us into war. You know, like always. Yeah. So, yeah, man, I'm Scott, and I got a bunch of wars to talk about. First, let me say real quickly here, and I swear I'm not going to talk about... I should never say real quickly. That always means I'm going to spend the whole segment on something. But no, I'm not. I swear. I'm going to try really hard not to. The thing I'm going to say is this. Thank you. Thank you very much to all the supporters of the show, all the people who donate, all the people who are the regular subscribers, all the people who send nice emails about how they're quitting the army now because they've been listening here. I love those, man. Thank you especially to my advertisers. So, I better get the list in front of me so I don't screw it up. That is The War State and Wall Street Window by the great Mike Swanson. Please get that book. If you have money, you're trying to invest it, you want to know what the hell is going on in the world, you want investment advice from somebody who understands real economics, wallstreetwindow.com for the great Mike Swanson there. Phil Giraldi and his group, the Council for the National Interest, help support this show as well. I'm very proud of that fact. They're the antidote to the Israel lobby in Washington, D.C. That's what they are, the Council for the National Interest. And, of course, the Future Freedom Foundation as well. I've got some newer, and Liberty stickers and the bumpersticker.com, which my friend Tracy and I invented back in 2003. And then we both sold out our share to Rick McGinnis because he's actually a businessman. And he has succeeded in turning the bumpersticker.com and libertystickers.com into a successful business for now 11 years, longer than a decade. He has kept that business going strong and employed a lot of people and helped a lot of people get stickers for their bands and their businesses and anti-government propaganda for the back of their vehicles. And he's helped support this show a little bit here and there, too. And so that's Rick McGinnis at thebumpersticker.com and libertystickers.com. And now Whole Food Multi-Complete is no scam about it. Ain't no multi-level marketing. Ain't no magical promises from, the health kookery movement or anything like that. It's just damn good vitamins. That's all it is. And it's all whole food stuff, not synthesized chemicals. And check them out. Read all about it. It's a very in-depth website. Has great questions and answers and everything you need to know there at wholefoodcomplete.com. Whole Food Multi-Complete Vitamins there. Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. You can buy gold through them. Gold, silver, platinum, palladium. Precious metals, protect yourself and your long-term investments from the wages of inflation. And they accept bitcoins too, which is good in case you got some bitcoins and now you want to move them from Bitcoin into something a bit more tangible. And another book, Thomas Harrington, I'm going to have him back on the show here real soon to talk about his book, Living La Vida Baroka. American culture in an age of imperial orthodoxies. And yeah, he's a liberal, but he's peace and freedom first like me. Hopefully when you listen to this show, you only sort of occasionally get the idea I'm a libertarian because that's not really what the show's about. I'm only selling libertarianism mostly kind of by proxy that, wow, the guy who is the best on all foreign policy, everything in the world happens to be a libertarian. I wonder if that's a coincidence or if there's a causation to that correlation, you might wonder. But it's all about just stopping the war and rolling back the police state. And you don't have to be a libertarian to believe in that. Everybody ought to believe in that. So that's the same thing here as Thomas Harrington, Living La Vida Baroka. He's a counterpunch lefty, the kind I like. And he's got some great essays in there. I think you'll really enjoy it. Living La Vida Baroka. And again, you probably heard him on the show. He's a professor of Spanish history. So he has all this great spin on the American Empire from the point of view of somebody who knows everything about the history of Spain and its empire and the aftermath of the collapse of its empire and all these other things. It's very insightful and good. I really think you'll like it. And if you're thirsty and you're a caffeine addict like me, then you need Darren's Coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. He's been very generous in helping to support the show as well. And let me also mention My Heroes Think. He makes busts of Rothbard, Harry Brown, and Ron Paul. They're really good, man. I got the Harry Brown one. I want the Ron Paul. Also Pizza Noir by Denver Day. It's a little bit of a departure for this show. It's a novel and a pretty creepy one. I think you'll like it. About a detective on the hunt for who's killing the roller derby girls. It's cool, man. And Go-Kart Galaxy and Web Dev Geeks, have both been very generous in helping to support the show as well. Web Dev Geeks, oh, they'll help you build a website. That's their thing. And Go-Kart Galaxy, well, go-kart and mini bike parts. GoKartGalaxy.com. So those people support this show, and you could be like them and also help support the show. Did I leave anybody out? Boy, I hope I didn't. The 10th Amendment Center, they support a little bit. I sure support them anyway. I'll mention them, 10th Amendment Center. And let's see. I mentioned Harrington and them and them and then. Okay, yeah, that's everybody. Thank you very much to everybody who helps support the show. And you too could help support the show, and I'll tell everybody all about what you do for your business, what it is you're selling, or what your awesome group is trying to stop, or whatever it is. Just contact me, scott@scotthorton.org, and I'm sure we can work something out. My prices are very reasonable. And I think you can tell from some of the long-term advertisers on this show that they think they're getting their money worth, their money's worth, right? It was hard to sell those little metal Bill of Rights's to such a degree that they really paid for the ads, you know, because they're really cheap. And they're awesome, but they got a really slim margin, you know. Kind of hard to keep supporting the show with those. But anyway, that was the best ad we ever did, right? I'll replay that sometime just for fun. All right, anyway, so... yeah, this is my show. You could help support the show, too, and I'll help support your gig back. Check out details at scott@scotthorton. Scott@scotthorton.org. That's my email. Also, you can just go to scotthorton.org/support or scotthorton.org/donate, and there's details on how to get a hold of me there and all that. So, cool. Advertise on the show. Thank you. All right, good. So, yeah, hey, look, somebody just sent me $10. Thank you very much, Alan. It's worth it to be polite. Worth $10. Hell yeah. All right. Now, why would anybody support the show anyway? Because I'm just trying to stop wars. That's all I'm trying to do. I'm trying to stop the U.S. government from killing people. That's basically the bottom line of the whole thing. And just like always... But yes, also with this war, the case against war is the perfect case against intervention altogether. It's perfectly clear that the crisis in Iraq and Syria has been created by the United States, just as well as it's clear that any further intervention will only make it worse. Hell, I skipped one. It's clear that American intervention already has made it worse. And will continue to make it worse. Now, it's true that it does seem like with help from Kurdish, you know, America's helping the Kurdish militias on the ground in Kobani now. Dropped them supplies, dropped them weapons, dropped them laser designators that they've been using on ISIS. And apparently have prevented them from taking the city, as so many people were predicting before. The war nerd says what happened was Leon Panetta called Obama a sissy. And it was at that point, that was the turning point in the Kobani policy, where they changed from, well, you know, it might fall and don't worry about it. Now, I agree with him. I was wondering if anybody else was going to say the same thing as me about that, because it's a little conspiratorial, but the war nerd apparently agrees with me, and I agree with him that, yeah, it looks like, wait, was it the war nerd who wrote this, or maybe it was someone else? I shouldn't invoke him, because now I'm doubting whether that's the same thing I was reading or not. I think it was. That, yeah, they're doing a favor for Turkey there. Oh, you want to kill Kurds or you want to sit back and watch ISIS kill Kurds? Fine. That's cool with us. That, in other words, the Americans weren't all so frustrated with the Turks for not intervening. You know, they're fine with that. But then Panetta made fun of Obama, so he needed some kind of tactical victory and whatever. Anyway, so point being... that on the very narrow, short-term tactical level, yes, American airstrikes can be effective when, you know, coordinated with people on the ground at turning back a militia from a full-scale assault on a city. But so what does that prove, though? Not much. That's war through a soda straw, as Robert Gates might say. The question is, what effect do all those American bombings have on the narrative of the entire war there, and what effect does it have on support for the Islamic State in Iraqi and Syrian Sunnistan? Huh? Huh? Well, it's backfiring. Everybody knows it. everybody knows is counterproductive and yet persist. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show on the line. I got the great Gareth Porter from Interpress Service. That's ipsnews.net, ipsnews.net. He also writes for truthout.org. We rerun virtually all of it at antiwar.com, original.antiwar.com/Porter is where you can find that whole archive. And, of course, he's the author of the book Manufactured Crisis. Literally wrote the book on it, the so-called Iranian nuclear weapons program, which Gareth shows never existed. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you doing?
Hi, Scott. Glad to be back. I'm good.
Good, good. Very happy to have you back on the show. And, of course, we spoke just the other day about your interview with a former very high-level member of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Forces about the old Ayatollah Khomeini's edict that chemical and nuclear weapons were banned. Now, your next piece, it's sort of old news, but just because you debunked it before doesn't mean they quit trying. And so you've had to now at IPS News debunk again. So we're here to give you a platform to do a little bit of that debunking too. The headline is History of Key Document in IAEA Probe Suggests Israeli Forgery. Now, this is extra super important because we're right in the middle of talks trying to get a final nuclear agreement with Iran where America will back off the threats of war, repeal the sanctions, and the Iranians will allow for these expanded inspections, so expanded that it makes the Americans happy enough, maybe disconnect enough centrifuges, divert a few projects to different purposes, that kind of thing, so that there can finally be an agreement. And yet, in the midst of this, the IAEA says, hey, we've got some serious unanswered questions that the Iranians have not completely fessed up about experiments on nuclear weapons technology, Gareth. So it seems pretty damn important if that, in fact, is true, but you seem to think not. So first of all, can you tell us about what is it exactly that they're referring to? And then secondly, we'll get to why it is that you're so skeptical of the origins of this evidence.
Well, this this document, which is the focal point of the article, is what I call the high explosives document. It's also referred to in that way in a lot of news media coverage. It is a document that appeared on the scene in 2008, which the IAEA, as usual, mysteriously obtained without ever naming officially the source of the document. It showed up on the list of documents in the May 2008 IAEA report, which had been shown to Iran and was briefly described as, and I'm not going to try to make sure that the wording is the same, but essentially it was said to be a description of experiments with high explosives that involved a multi-point initiation concept. And the implication was left that this was a very strong indication of a nuclear weapons related experiment. And that, of course, has been the IAEA claim ever since. And then it went on in subsequent months. In the next IAEA report in September 2008, the very scintillating, shall we say, detail was added to this previous report about the high explosives document, that it was reported that a foreign expert had helped the Iranians carry out these experiments, and that the Iranians had been asked to explain themselves with regard to this foreign expert. And of course, we now know that the foreign expert was none other than the Ukrainian scientist Vyacheslav Danilenko. And we've talked about him on your show before, but you know, he now, I think, is again relevant to understanding what's going on in the politics surrounding the IAEA role in relation to the nuclear talks. And I just want to very quickly, before we lose sight of this or before it gets forgotten, make sure everyone understands that the IAEA and the P5 plus one are taking the position that Iran must explain all of these documents, and particularly at this point, the one that's on the top of the agenda is the high explosives document, or otherwise there will not be a comprehensive agreement, that the Iranian explanation to the satisfaction of the IAEA is a precondition for, or a condition for, the successful negotiation of the comprehensive agreement. In fact, I've even seen a report suggesting, it seems credible to me that this is the case, that the P5 plus one is taking the position in the talks that if the Iranians are not able to explain satisfactorily the various claims that are made in these documents within the first phase of the agreement, that then the P5 plus one would not withdraw the sanctions in the subsequent phase of the agreement. So that's the significance at this point of this document.
Right. In other words, it's absolutely huge and
yes.
could sink the deal.
It could sink the deal indeed. And that is why it's extremely important that some understanding of what this issue is really all about gets a broader audience.
All right. Now, so before we get back to all of that, and we will, let me ask you this. It seems to me there's a very small number of reporters who cover this kind of topic in America's national security beat. You got Laura Rosen, you got Barbara Slavin, you got Scott Peterson, and the guys over at NIAC, and that's just about it, right? And of course the hacks, right? George John and David Sanger, but
right. So, and don't forget Reuters as well. Reuters always files. Every time there's a turning point in the IAEA Iran saga, they always file a story or two. So they have to be included.
But all those people that I name by name at first there, those are people who, they're not perfect necessarily all the time or whatever, but they're pretty damn good on this stuff. And I believe it was Scott Peterson reported, as well as you did, that Robert Kelly from the IAEA wasn't buying into this. So my question for you is that never mind whether Israel forged the document for the moment. We'll cover that. But for the purposes of these other reporters, have they not been shown enough reason to be under the consensus now? Are they not under the consensus now that, that story had already fallen apart because simply Kelly didn't believe it? And if Kelly didn't believe it, then that's it. He was the guy in the position to know at the IAEA. So they wouldn't have to go necessarily be as good as you on Danilenko or on the origin of the document or anything else to have reason to just... I'm sorry it's taken so long, Gareth. What I'm trying to ask you is, isn't it the consensus among these few Iran nuclear reporters in America that they already don't believe this story? And yet, it's still going on? The government is still treating this as though it's a legitimate deal breaker for these talks?
Two points about that. One, the first point is that I would say that most of the reporters that you've referred to have not written debunking or questioning the high explosives document. Certainly, the Monitor has quoted Bob Kelly, Robert Kelly, and he did have a piece in Bloomberg, in 2012, debunking the document.
Oh yeah, Yosef Butt, he's really good on this stuff too. There's a writer who's good.
Right. But most of the journalists that you've mentioned have not indeed debunked this or questioned it. And the second point is that the coverage of the recent developments in this storyline, that is, what has happened in the meetings between the IAEA and Iran since August, have uniformly suggested that Iran has been remiss, has been stonewalling, has been refusing to cooperate, has failed to provide the necessary information that the IAEA has demanded about this document. So
I see.
Even if there had been some debunking in the past, it has now been forgotten. It's never brought up. It right. certainly has not been brought up.
And unless the document is debunked, they're going to carry on under the impression that the whole line of questioning is legit. I see.
Exactly.
All right, now, I'm sorry, because I already screwed us up, and we got to take this break. Hold it right there, Gareth. We'll be right back, everybody, with Gareth Porter from Interpress Service. History of key document in IAEA probe suggests Israeli forgery. No kidding, huh? Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm sorry, I ran us all into the break there. So I was asking Garrett, but don't the other reporters know better than this now? And his basic answer, that was my question in a nutshell, and his answer in a nutshell was, as long as the documents aren't debunked, they think that the IAEA and the member states of the UN and the P5+1, this and that, that they have, the UN Security Council, that is, that they have a presumed reason to legitimately complain here that the Iranians are not coming out with everything. So that's what we talked about there during the break.
And I would also just add very quickly, yeah. Scott, that most of the coverage in recent weeks, that is since August, has been Reuters reporting on this story. Reuters and AP, it really has not been the subject of reportage in major newspapers at all. So we have been depending on reporters who have certainly had less of a record of looking into this question in the past. That's right. For sure.
Yeah, less experienced ones, yeah. Okay, and that's important on this story because you got to be able to remember back and go, but what about David Kelly? Or Robert Kelly, pardon.
No historical context, yeah. No historical background at all. Right. In
okay, now, so tell me if I'm right about this. What you're saying is that there are, is it two or more hard reasons to disbelieve what this document claims is right? And one is that we already know who the scientist is they're referring to, and he wasn't a nuclear weapons scientist. He was a nanodiamond scientist, and that accounts for the implosion system. He's not trying to split uranium atoms. He's trying to make tiny little carbon atoms into the shape of nanodiamonds. And that then this guy, Robert Kelly, from the IAEA, agrees with that. And then the other thing is that the IAEA had their pick of places to inspect there at Parchin, where all this took place, and back in 2005, and they were satisfied then that there was nothing to find there. What else am I missing as far as that? And then I want to let you go on all the reasons that you believe that it was forged by the Israelis, kind of as the separate question in a second.
Just on the 2005 IAEA visit to Parchin, there's a point that relates to that I believe I made in my book. I'm pretty sure I did, which really needs to be repeated and expanded on, and that is that if the Iranians had anything to hide at Parchin, and the presumption that you've just talked about, of course, is that the Iranians did in fact have something to hide, which was this gigantic alleged cylinder for testing nuclear weapons designs or whatever, but somehow related to nuclear weapons research. And had they had something like that to hide, they never would have allowed the IAEA twice to go into Parchin to pick out whatever sites they wanted to visit in one of the four quadrants on two different occasions to visit five sites in each case of their own choice. And none other than Ali Heinonen has said that the Iranians didn't know which sites we were going to choose until we arrived on the site. So, I mean, that to me is the absolute, verification of the fact that Iran had nothing to hide, certainly had no, bomb test cylinder to hide at Parchin.
Well, and I got something to add here, too, which is I'm friends with Gordon Prather, who's the former chief scientist of the Army and had a career making nuclear weapons and working at Sandia National Laboratory, et cetera, et cetera. A real expert's expert at literally fusing hydrogen atoms together. He could kill your whole city. And he said, that's not how you test an implosion system for a nuclear weapon anyway, inside a chamber like that. You got to do it out in the open. And
yeah, exactly,
and then you need all this super high speed X-ray film in order to play it back at extra super slow-mo. And then you got to repeat the test hundreds of times to get it right. And they don't have the technology to do this. And that's not even what the accusation is. So just forget it.
Bob Kelly said exactly the same thing. So, I mean, there's no question. This is a completely, I mean, it makes no sense technically whatsoever, that whole story. But in addition to that, I make the point that the history of this document, the origins of the document show that there's no question it came from the Israelis. First of all, you know, I just found this out since my book was published, that there was an article in Jane's it was the May 1st, 2008 edition, but it was actually dated March 14th, 2008, which said, well, I've just been shown by a source connected with Western intelligence these documents which show that Iran was experimenting with, some sort of multi-point initiation system or language which was similar to that. So he's clearly talking about the high explosives document. And then he said, and what this shows is that the NIE of December 2007 was wrong, which, of course, was the Israeli propaganda line. So whoever was showing him that was making the argument on behalf of the Israelis if it wasn't the Israeli intelligence people themselves who passed it on. And so that's the first clue that this was indeed an Israeli document. But the second thing, of course, is that our friend David Albright, who was close to Ali Heinonen, was a good friend of Ali Heinonen, told me in September 2008.
Now, wait, slow down one second here. Ali Heinonen, everybody, is a very hawkish, anti-Iranian type individual, formerly at very high levels of the IAEA, now a professor at Harvard, and he's always leaking hawkish stuff to the media. That's the subtext there. Go ahead.
Correct. So Heinonen told David Albright, according to this interview that I had with Albright in September 2008, that there was a certain document that was very important to him, which had come to him in earlier that year in 2008. Well, there's only one document that coincides with that description, and that's the high explosives document. Albright said to me it was probably Israel that gave him the document. And of course, all of the evidence indicates that the documentation that has come since 2008, has been from the Israelis. Mohammed El-Baradei said so in his own memoirs. And El-Baradei, is not going to say that unless it's well-founded, because he was not trying to make enemies of the United States. Believe me, he was trying to keep on the good side of the United States, but he felt so strongly about what the Israelis were doing that he had to tell the truth in his memoirs about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he, of course, also said he never saw any indication that the Iranians were pursuing nuclear weapons. So never mind. All the atom count was still always the same when it came to non-diversion. But he just, in other words, he never was under the impression that they were. It never seemed to him that they were, as loosely as you could define it, the former director of the IAEA.
El-Baradei knew very well that the Israelis were passing him false documents. And he says so in his memoirs that some of the documents that they examined at the agency, they had very serious questions about their authenticity, and they queried the Israelis about that. And it's, I've had word from a former IAEA official saying that they were, a number of people there knew that there was something wrong with these documents, that they were not authentic. It didn't add up.
Right. Well, and here's one more big reason to think that this document must have come from the Israelis and maybe probably even, created by them. And that would be all of your other journalism on the laptop, the so-called smoking laptop or laptop of death. That's a bunch of crap, which you're reporting in your book and for IPSnews.net has completely deconstructed and destroyed for all time. So would seem to indicate the same sort of deal here. I'm sorry we're all out of time, but that's the great Gareth Porter, everybody. IPSnews.net, history of key document. An IAEA probe suggests Israeli forgery. You can also find it at original.antiwar.com/Porter. Thanks very much, Gareth. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hey, join up the chat room during the show. There's a bunch of dudes in there today. Maybe some girls. I don't know. Everybody's got a fake name. But anyway, there's some humans in there of whatever different descriptions. It's the IRC free node chat room hashtag Scott Horton Show. Hashtag Scott Horton Show. And also, you can just go to scotthorton.org/chat. That's pretty easy. scotthorton.org/chat. Yes, the website was down, had some server upgrades and then a server difficulty, and now everything's straight again. scotthorton.org/chat if you want to join in there, or use your Pigeon or Chatzilla or XChat or however the hell else you do it if you like. And then I just got an email from Jimmy. Hey, Jimmy. That's cool that you still listen to the show after all this time, man. Appreciate it. Roku, he says. LRN.FM is on Roku. Which I think is like some kind of gizmo for your TV, right? Something like that. That lots of people have and know about. Anyway, if you're looking for me and, you're thinking, if only he was on the Roku thing, whatever, how you say it. Well, I am. Apparently, according to Jimmy. LRN.FM is on Roku. So, thank the digital lords for that. And take note. And never forget. You know, if you're interested in that kind of thing. Which apparently you are because you're listening right now, at least for now. All right. So I got to talk about the Bada Brigade and all this in a minute. But that top of the hour spot for that guy's show, he said, Mondays with Murray. Every Monday, I'll talk about Murray Rothbard on the show. Hey, that's probably a good idea. Today's Monday. And not to steal this guy's thunder, because he probably knows the name of a lot more Rothbard articles than me, since he's made it his business to do this every Monday. So I'm not plagiarizing, I'm just inspired. And I know that there are people who listen to the show who wonder, huh, what is this I'm listening to anyway? Who are these people? What the hell? And, well, you know, a good way to become familiar would be to read up some Rothbard. And so I didn't really sit and write down a list, although I probably tried to. But here's my very favorite one. And this will really teach you about libertarianism, especially if you're some kind of liberal and you've been told that you hate libertarians and everything that they're about and this kind of thing. I think, this will help learn you a couple of things, even if it doesn't convince you everything. I think you'll like it. It's called Left and Right, The Prospects for Liberty. Left and Right, The Prospects for Liberty by Murray Rothbard. Yep, that's my very favorite one. And then, of course, second place to that would have to be War, Peace, and the State. War, Peace, and the State. By Murray Rothbard. And then also, Anatomy of the State. Ooh, that's a favorite. Anatomy of the State. You'll definitely want to read that. And for that matter, chapter 14 of For a New Liberty is called War and Foreign Policy. And I think that'll do you some good. If you read chapter 14 of For a New Liberty, it's called War and Foreign Policy by Murray Rothbard. And then also, of course, there's Wall Street, Banks, and American Foreign Policy. All of these are available online, of course. Wall Street, Banks, and American Foreign Policy. It's a monograph, a very short book online. It's a big, long article. And oh, man, is it just so awesome. It's so awesome. And now, by the way, this guy wrote also The History of the Founding of America, a massive four-part series conceived in liberty four massive books. I mean, he also, the way they say, and what the hell do I know, but the rumor is that he took Mises, is it Mises's Human Action, and perfected it with Man, Economy, and State. I've never read either of them, although I really should, I think. And he also wrote the two-part History of Economic Thought on the Planet, which, yeah. So, in other words, Rothbard really, well, it's hard to say really. Really, he was a hell of a lot of things and wore a hell of a lot of hats. Primarily, he was an author and an economics professor, an Austrian school economist. But also a massive historian and a libertarian political activist and a polemicist par extraordinaire excellence without compare. Murray Rothbard. So those are my favorites. The left, the right, and the state. No. The left and right. Prospects for Liberty. The left and right and the state. That's Lou Rockwell. That's a pretty good book. You'll like it, but that's something different. Left and right. The Prospects for Liberty. This is the one where people say to me, holy crap, man, my mind is blown. I'm like, I'm tired after reading that. I'm different now. What do I do with all this new stuff in my brain? I got to sort it out. All the things that I thought, I got to look at them again now. Huh. Left and right, The Prospects for Liberty, War, Peace, and the State, War and Foreign Policy, Anatomy of the State. I'm out of order now. Wall Street Banks and American Foreign Policy. These are my very favorites. So, you know. Oh, and then, you know what, too? There's an interview of Rothbard that you can find at lourockwell.com or at antiwar.com. Here's what you search. Our anti-imperialist heritage. Our anti-imperialist heritage. And there's Murray Rothbard explaining what it means to be a libertarian. You can find that at antiwar.com. It's an interview that he did with Reason Magazine in, I think, 1978 or something like that. Anyway, great stuff. I am an evangelical libertarian. I don't usually dwell on it too much on the show, but it is, I guess. I don't know. But I would like to, I'm like a Christian or a Muslim in this sense. I want to spread libertarianism to the world. I ain't happy until y'all freaking agree with me. So quit being such idiots. I mean, quit differing with me at all about anything. Or else I will talk at you some more and see if I can persuade you to change your mind. At least recommend some reading. So you'll see what it is that I like. All right. Murray Rothbard, he was the gigantic brain who conceived of the anarcho-individualism for the 21st century. 20th, I meant to say. But now this one, too. Not that he invented individualist anarchism. I'm just saying he's the guy that carried the banner. He was against everything, man. What a great role model. All right. Now here's the thing. When we get back from the break, I'm going to tell you about the Botter Brigade. And I know you've heard this one, but not all of you. And, well, look, this is my comparative advantage in the marketplace, is that I can tell you the history of the Iraq War in a nutshell in a way that you get it. That's what I do. And so there's very important news, and I got some very important background for you on that news and the future of the Iraq War. And just, oh. When I was a kid, I used to watch Night Court, and I swear I Googled the hell out of this. I used as many different search terms as I could. And I just can't find a good still picture of Bull Shannon slapping himself in the forehead. That was Night Court's version of dope. But I think of that all the time. Just dope. God dang it, man. It ain't supposed to be this way. That would be my Twitter profile picture, I think, if I could find a good JPEG of that. That is an open invitation to all of you as well, yes. If you can find me that picture. And Kobani news, too. I'll talk about that. But more importantly, we're going to talk about, the war. the eastern end of the war. Yeah, the west too. More Iraq than Syria, but do these things even exist anymore? That's a question too. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. Yeah, no, man. Harry, the judge, was a real magician, man. He was good. I wonder whatever happened to him. All right, y'all. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm a radio show. Now, here's the deal about this Bottle Brigade, man. Iraqi lawmakers okay Sunni Shiite to fill two top cabinet security posts. All right, well, so who's the Shiite? The Shiite is, his name doesn't matter, actually, because he's just the sock puppet of the other guy. Mohammed Salem Gaban is his name. But he's from the Bada Brigade. And the leader of the Bada Brigade, as we read in the Washington Post, in this article, appointment of Iraq's new interior minister opens door to militia and Iranian influence. We read correctly that it's really all about this guy, Amiri. And what's his whole name again? Hadi al-Amiri is the head of the Badr organization. Now, it's basically just the militia of what at least used to be, I think it's still called, the Iraqi Supreme Islamic Council. And, or no, it's the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq is the acronym now. They used to be the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, but then Bush waged their revolution for them. So they didn't have to be for it anymore. They then became conservatives. They're now the Supreme Council for keeping it this way. Because they got what they wanted. And now here's the deal about these guys. As far as I know, this report in the Washington Post is just right. I didn't see a thing in it that, conflicts with anything I know. It just helped inform me more, and it's a real problem. And I know scaremonger against Iran. I'm all for, as you know, total peace with Iran. I'm all for, I work as hard as anybody except Gareth Porter to debunk every lie about Iran that they'd tell. I want a normal and peaceful relationship with Iran. But that doesn't make me a friend of their regime whatsoever. And in fact, they really suck. And in fact, one of the worst things about Bush's war is just what he did for Iran and for their sock puppets in Iraq. He coulda never even, this just for the sake of argument, I opposed the war like hell. I did it not much, but everything that I could to try to make people aware of what a bunch of crap it was. And why it shouldn't happen. But just for the sake of argument anyway, Bush coulda gone in there. Even with the full-scale invasion and toppling of the Ba'ath regime in Baghdad, he could have then just left. You guys find Saddam. His government doesn't exist anymore. You know? Go ahead, bomb the crap for the sake of argument. Bomb the crap out of his government. Occupy Baghdad for 2 or 3 weeks. Prove that he doesn't rule it anymore, and then leave. They could have done that. They didn't do that. They stayed for years and years and years. If they had done that, there's no guarantee what would have happened. But the Shiite parties, who would be certain to be coming to power in their supermajority, would have had a hell of a lot more reason to compromise with the Sunnis, to limit Iranian influence to the contrary, and do like Muqtada al-Sadr wanted, and hold Iraq together in the name of Arab and Iraqi nationalism and peace. They would have had all the other Shiite leaders, in other words, would have had the incentive to follow what Sauder wanted to do, which was to not have a giant civil war against the Sunni Arabs. Yes, he certainly wanted the Shia to take the ruling position in the government. That didn't mean that he wanted to, lord it over the Sunnis to death the way the Iran-backed parties did. And the main Iran-backed party was the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution with their militia, the Badr Brigade. And now who were these guys? Well, they hadn't been Iraqis for 30 years. They fled Iraq into Iran and served the Iranian government in 1980 when Saddam invaded, when Jimmy Carter asked him to, as revenge for them overthrowing our sock puppet dictatorship in 1979 and embarrassing Carter with the hostages. They fled to Iran. They served the Ayatollah. And now you could understand, maybe if you were in their position, they might too. Powerful Shiite enemies of Saddam aren't safe in Iraq. But anyway, never mind personally blaming them for the dishonor of that or whatever. That's not the point. The point is they spent 30 years in Iran. The Iranian government trained and created their Badr Brigade. That's who these guys are. And when George Bush invaded, Ahmed Chalabi told them, yeah, here are the smart, educated, well-dressed, well-spoken leaders among the Shiites that we can deal with. And Bush and them all agreed that, well, what else are they going to do? Work with Muqtada al-Sadr, the scum of the earth, whose first priority is kicking them out, who's some working-class bum from, you know, the Bush people's point of view. I think that did have a lot to do with it, whereas al-Hakim was, you know, sophisticated and, you know, like Hamid Karzai, he might be some kind of savage, but at least he wears soft cloth or whatever, you know, from the point of view of a Bush and a Rove, you understand. These are our guys. These are the ones that the Americans bet on. Oh, and they came with their own army that from the Republicans' point of view was happy to serve them. But who was serving who? It was the Americans. The U.S. Army and the U.S. Marine Corps and the CIA and the rest of them, the U.S. government, the Bush regime, they were the used and then thrown out sock puppets of the Iranians and their agents, the Supreme Islamic Council and the Badr Brigade. And now the premise of America's renewed war in Iraq is that now that we've gotten rid of Maliki, the jerk, you know, Bush's pick, that succeeded Bush's other pig, Jafari, the jerk. Now that we've got a body from the exact same Dawa party as Maliki and Jafari before him, he's going to create an inclusive government. Now that Humpty Dumpty has been smashed into a trillion pieces on fire, we're going to bring in a new guy from the exact same party, the Dawa Party, which is basically at this point just a subset of the Supreme Islamic Council, their closest ally, for they lack their own militia, and they've worked together hand in glove this entire time. If anything, you could say Dawa is a compromise between the Muqtada al-Sadr group, the Mahdi army, he has his own army too, and the Supreme Islamic Council, but the Dawa Party has shared the goals of the Supreme Islamic Council all along. And that is a strong Iraqi federalism, meaning use the Americans to kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad and take it, and then just run off with all Shiistan and screw the Sunnis. No point trying to rule them. That's why the army fled. It wasn't their territory in June, I mean, when ISIS came. It wasn't their territory. Flee back to Shiistan. George W. Bush's stand, Ayatollah Sistani land, whatever you want to call it, what's left of Iraq under the control of the Shia. And that's why, since Bush was their sock puppet and used the army and the Marines to kick all of their enemies out of Baghdad, you know, to kill them all out of Baghdad, they've had no reason to compromise with the Sunnis whatsoever. And so when Petraeus came up with this scheme, well, listen, we will pay the Sunni tribal leaders so much money that they'll stop fighting us, and we'll make them all these promises about being integrated into the army and the police and into the government and getting on the oil, welfare dole and all that. The Shiites never kept that end of the bargain, because at the very same time, Petraeus was helping them wrap up the civil war and the seizing of, 85% of Baghdad or more. And so they had no more reason to compromise whatsoever. And now Abadi is bringing in the Bada Brigade, the leader of the Bada Brigade Army, the guy who, as the Washington Post correctly notes here, quoting Chelsea Manning's heroically, self-sacrificially leaked WikiLeaks documents, the Iraq war logs and State Department cables, that yes, in fact, these guys from the Bada Brigade that Donald Rumsfeld and Robert Gates' military worked hand in glove with these guys throughout that entire war. They like to torture people to death with power drills through the skull. That's the American way. Bush and Rumsfeld and Gates, they made it. America's method of torturing people to death, because they just adopted the Bada Brigade, and here Obama continues the grand tradition. These guys are nothing but ISIS on the Shiite side and backed by Iran, and they're supposed to win over, but these guys are going to win over the Sunnis into the inclusive new government. That's the premise for the new war. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com.
Huh, isn't that something? Is this from today? Huh. Man, I need to ask Jason about this.
Friend just emailed me. Said, so what's going on here? And then he sent me a link to a total mystery. What the hell do I know? I don't know. ISIS cited as Michigan villages police push for secrecy. Oakley has 290 residents, writes Jason Ditz at antiwar.com/blog. They also have over 100 cops. What? Less than 300 people, 100 cops? And they won't even say what their names are. The chief assures them many of them have never even been there. Huh? And it's all secrecy, and when the townspeople try to find out, the cops say, you can't tell us about these guys. We can't tell you about these guys. Because ISIS, as Jason writes, yes, that ISIS is a potential threat to the police if their names were made public. Is that really a basis for the secrecy of the names of all sheriffs and all their deputies in America? In all 20,000 police jurisdictions? ISIS might explode them with their black magic. The letter went on to warn that because everyone knows ISIS is a thing, and knows ISIS would want to get a hold of Oakley police, releasing their names would be a malicious act, one for which punitive damages could be awarded. Wow, America. America. What a funny place. America's government completely out of control. The American people were just beside ourselves because we don't know what the hell we can do about it. I don't know. I guess there are slight and limited examples of democracy pushing back a little bit. The people, I mean, using democracy to push back a little bit. In Wisconsin and now in New Jersey, they have passed state laws and had the governor sign state laws mandating some kind of independence when it comes to investigation of police shootings. That internal affairs from the same department, that's not good enough. It's got to be somebody from some other agency, at least, is part of the process of the investigation of all these police shootings in their states. And actually, reading the quote from the lady in New Jersey, the state representative in New Jersey, it was, from their point of view, all about shoring up confidence in the police and the state government. that, whoa, we're getting to the point here where people don't want us around at all anymore, and that could cost us all our money, you know. We want it. And so somebody's got to restrain these cops a little bit. We start treating everybody in America like they've treated black people all along. People who actually have a little bit of political power might start pushing back, might start getting angry. And, of course, the cops are so out of control, they end up kicking in former mayor's doors because they're just kicking in the wrong damn doors all the time. They don't do the slightest bit of investigation about what they're doing. They kick in the door and kill the mayor's dog. You know, that kind of thing happens. That one specific thing did happen. Anyway, so at some point, there's a little bit of rollback on this. In fact, in Michigan, there was a thing. I don't think this is the same town. There was a town where the police chief died, and the new guy came in, and he just brought in these janissaries from where the hell he found them. And they immediately went to war against the people of this small county, sparsely populated area. And they went to war back. And just said, you can't do this. The people that you're treating as though, you know, they're Jews in your Nazi concentration camp? Why, that's the most prominent business leader in town that we respect more than we respect you by a lot. And so at some point, there's a limit here. Because you're not going to convince us he's the bad guy. We know he's not. It must be you. And they were pushing, I think, to have their police, they did actually succeed in having him resign. The local city council made him resign. Which means he gets to keep all his money, right? He wasn't fired for his misconduct. But still, I am an anarchist, and I don't participate in politics, but I don't accuse people of participating in politics, because... you know, I think at times it can be beneficial to try to hold the line a little bit if you can do it. And after all, the reason I was exposed to Harry Brown was because he was running for president. That's the only time most people pay attention to politics at all, is when it's a presidential election, when they have the least amount of influence out of all elections. That's when they pay attention. That's when they vote. Between the two choices that they've been given at the last minute, you know? And, so anyway, it could be useful. I mean, wouldn't you like to see all the blacks of Ferguson completely and entirely depose the town council, even if they had to resort to democracy to do it? And just put all poor black people in charge of the cops and every aspect of the government. And who cares if they don't know anything about it? I mean, if there are people from the projects who don't know anything about running government, even better. Destroy the damn thing. Why should they have to be subjected to the rule? Don't they have the right to secede? And might it be easier for them to just outvote? Although, you know, there were all these headlines that said 3,000 new registered voters in Ferguson, and then they backpedaled on that, and they said, no, actually, that's the raw number of all changes of people who moved and changed their address and this kind of thing. The actual number of new voters, a couple of hundred. Not enough to make a difference. Enough to make people really disappointed when they've been told 3,000 new voters and how this is going to be a huge new thing next time. But it could happen. Not really. On the margins, there are ways that we can push back, and I think it's okay to use politics sometimes to do that. Anyway. Here. Arms to the Kurds, or airdropping arms to the Kurds in Kobani. This is in the western part of the Islamic State, so-called, in eastern Syria, on the border with Turkey. Turkey, of course, hates the Kurds, really just hates the Kurds, full stop, but then also especially hate the PKK communists, the Kurdistan Workers Party, and all of their adjuncts. It's the PKK in Turkey, it's PJAK in Iran, it's the YPG in Syria, and from the point of view of the Turkish government, let them all kill each other. Let them all go to hell except Cave 76. Let them all go to hell except Cave 76. And so that's their policy. But now, as I was quoting you earlier, the war nerd says, and I agree with this analysis, seems like the simplest answer. The war nerd says that it was because Panetta called Obama a wimp that he had to change his policy from agreeing with the Kurds that, yeah, let them all die. Who cares? Let Kobani fall. What do I care? To, uh-oh, I better do something about it. And as the war nerd gives the Kurds a lot of credit. He says, these guys, they don't scare so easy. And, you know, this is something that we've talked about on this show all along with the Islamic State, is that their terror is a force multiplier, big time. That's why they put out videos of them making people dig their own graves and then shooting them in the back of the head. Because they want you to run rather than risk it. But when it comes to trying to take Kobani from the Kurds, Warnerd informs me, and my view on this, they've been trying to take Kobani from the Kurds for a year and a half. Oh no, pardon me. That's overstating it. Almost a year and a quarter or so. And yet the Kurds, they're not giving it up and they're not afraid. So they stand and fight, and that makes things much more difficult for the Islamic State, which still, for calling itself the state, is really nothing but Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Way too big for their britches, like they always tried to be. And so Obama was shamed and dropping them some laser pointers and dropping some bombs and helping them there. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betray their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy. The off-now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. Man, so did you see the news about everybody walking out of a fundraiser for a politician where Obama showed up to help? And everybody hates him so much that many of them turn around and left, and one guy started heckling him. Multiple sources on this now, too, so don't go saying, oh, it's just a Washington Times story or something like that. And I just think that is great, man. Isn't it great to see a president have no credibility? To see regular people think, you're not so special. I met him in person, he's just some guy. They say to each other. Seems like a schmuck to me. I can't believe I used to believe that crap, they say. And of course it works every time. They just flip-flop back and forth between the parties, and half the people are satisfied, and then when that gets worn out, the other half get to have their guy for a little while, and the other side has to complain. That way nobody ever does anything about anything. But anyway, I just think that's great. Now, personally, I hated Bill Clinton and George W. Bush way more than Obama. And it may just be because I guess I'm older now and I just don't hate in general quite as much. But who am I kidding? Right? I hate everything all the time. So, let me think. I mean, and Obama's the worst. He's just absolutely horrible in every way. I don't have a thing to say about him other than he's not McCain, as this was a Twitter discussion yesterday. Let's see, what can we say about Obama? Well, he's not McCain. There's that. The guy's absolutely horrible. But as far as, like, when I see him on TV, I don't really rage against him so much. I just, tune out. Bill Clinton, oh, I just despise. I start cussing like Fred Flintstone. Roger Bridges, son of a goddamn. And that George W. Bush, too. I see him on TV and be, oh, just, the goddamn. With Obama, I'm just, whatever, I don't know. He's absolutely horrible. I officially hate him. I scientifically, you know, quantifiably hate his sorry guts. And I think it's just hilarious that he was hugging and kissing people who literally had been caring for Ebola patients because, hey, man, anything happens there, that's suicide, dude. There's only one person has to take responsibility for that. And, you know, William Henry Harrison always was my favorite president. But anyway, no, I mean, he is as bad as Bush. But, you know, it's just that mood of these are the dark times. The Bush Revolution, the proud torture regime, you know? Lisa's not quite that. Sending a couple of 100,000 men into Iraq. Although I guess Obama may just, you know, prove he's that bad before he's done. But I guess we'll see. I don't know. And I guess people did end up booing and heckling Bush at some point, too. I just wish people would start out hating these guys. Wait to see if somehow they can make you love them by the end of their second term instead of the other way around. Oh, boy, these politicians just inspire so much hope in me. You all cry. I remember Bush versus Gore 2000. People tearing each other's eyes out over which one you prefer. And if anyone tried to ask them, oh, yeah? So what's your gripe? Make one solid case for your guy against the other guy. No one could differentiate between the two at all. It was just, oh man, not the Bush family. Those guys are corrupt Texas oil capitalists, and we just don't trust their motivations at all. So anybody but the Bushes, half the population cried. And then the other half said, oh God, not another 4 years of Clinton Gore. Oh, my God, we've had enough, and we don't like George Bush Jr., the stupid idiot, legacy spot holdover from his old man. But, oh, well, they rationalize, at least he'll have his father's advisors like Dick Cheney, you know, real adults in the room to make sure that everything is okay. And just no more Clinton Gore. The only real question was, which one do you hate more? I would ask people in my cab, who are you voting for? Why is that? And they would all say the other guy's worse. No one ever sang the positive praises of either. And yet, oh, they would tear each other's eyes out over, I can't believe you're on the other side. But nobody could really say what they hated other than the most basic description of the name of the guy's party and his geographical origin. And the one guy's the global warming guy and the other one is not, or whatever. Other than that, not a dime's worth of difference. Although, I gotta admit, though, I think that Al Gore would have gotten away with less than Junior. And I think he probably would not have invaded Iraq. I mean, he would have been absolutely horrible. I would have hated his guts, too. I already did hate his guts. But, you think he would have done Iraq the way Bush did? Nah, probably not. That would have changed a lot of things. You know, not that he was better as a person, but just would have had a different agenda, I think. Anyway. Gene Healy is coming on. He wrote a book called A Cult of the Presidency. Just happens to be exactly what I'm going on and on about right now. About how, man, people just love them some presidents. Even people who really ought to know better. They just can't help it. Gotta love something. Why not the worst person on the planet at any given moment? Why not identify with that power and authority? Doesn't that make you feel good? As Lou Rockwell says, that's what all those, you know, white marble statues are about in Washington, D.C. It's supposed to impress you. Wow, these people must really be important if they have all these giant statues of themselves everywhere. Or else, why would they build statues of themselves? It's all very subtle, you know, the way it's supposed to impress your psyche there. Anyway, yeah, Gene Healy on the War Powers coming up. Sorry for wasting your time. I did get to say a couple of substantive things about the war today, right? The Bada Brigade, the war for Kobani. And, you know, I mentioned, there's an article today. This has got to get mentioned here in the last minute. Daily Beast today, U.S. humanitarian aid going to ISIS. And not just that, but they blatantly admit it. It's perfectly fine. Jamie Dentmer at the Daily Beast, which is just Newsweek, And they're saying, yes, all this medical and food aid is going right to Raqqa City, right to ISIS, and they're distributing it, and they're the ones, and they're perfectly happy to work together. As we've talked about on the show before, they work together on polio vaccinations in order to stop an outbreak of polio. They're working really hard on their PR, the Islamic State guys. And the Americans continue working with them. And it does raise, it's not so one-sided. It really does raise a lot of questions about, as this one guy puts it, and you don't have to agree with his premises or whatever if you don't want, but there's a little something to this. Not that I think the U.S. government should exist, but really just because ISIS takes over a region, you stop feeding the civilian population there who are depending on you to not die. That's pretty mean. On the other hand, one of the guys who's against it here is quoted saying this is false. These brutal guys, the worst thing they have going for them is what bastards they are. And yet if we're feeding all the people they're ruling, we are helping to prop them up and protect them from a revolt. And we're not talking about a long established state with no chances of that by any means here. He's got a point. It's at the Daily Beast. Not that the U.S. should be doing it all, the government. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show, live here on the Liberty Radio Network, noon to 3 weekdays. And full archives at scotthorton.org. More than 3,500 interviews now going back to 2003. In fact, I think 2003 is when I first interviewed Gene Healy. He is vice president now at the Cato Institute. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Gene?
Hey, pretty good. How about you?
I'm doing real good. There's about a decade in there where I didn't interview you, but now I'm glad to have you back on the show.
Me too.
For some reason, it never did work out in the meantime there, but author of The Cult of the Presidency, a very important book, which is nonpartisan, believe me. All right, and now, so your article here at Cato.org today is the spotlight on antiwar.com, The Forever War President, Obama's Transformational War Powers Legacy. So what do you mean by, oh, it says here, originally appeared at The Federalist. What do you mean by transformational war powers legacy, Gene?
There's all this talk of transformational presidents, and Obama has said or is believed to have said that he wants, like many other presidents, to be a transformational president, somebody who really changes the political ground. And these are the presidents that typically in the scholars' ratings finish towards the top because they had new deals and new frontiers and new foreign adventures abroad. And I think one area where he's achieved this aim is probably not where he set out to achieve it. I think his legacy on war powers is something that is transformational. It is something new under the sun, where there have been, I mean, certainly we've had no shortage of presidential wars, wars without congressional authorization for from Harry Truman on especially. But I think what is happening in the Obama era is that you're getting into a situation where a quantitative difference is a qualitative one, where he is, as Professor Steve Vladek has put it, in danger of changing the constitutional default setting from peace to war. So while presidential wars in the past have been, they've been misguided, there have been, many occasions where presidents have struck out on their own without Congress, but those were by and large departures from a peacetime norm, whereas in the 21st century, what we're seeing is almost a wartime norm, that peace, periods without airstrikes and drone strikes and new bases abroad are really departures from a permanent backdrop of war.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the real thing of it is, too, even with this, well, and maybe especially with this much of his presidency behind him, it seems like he's probably as restrained in foreign policy as we could hope to expect a president to be in at least the next couple or few terms going forward. I mean, who do we have to pick from who's less belligerent than Barack Obama, who, after all, as you say here, continues to talk a good game about, hey, everybody, go back and make sure and read your James Madison. We don't want to do this forever, as he does it forever. Next is Jeb. Next is Hillary. What are we going to do?
Yeah, that's I wish I could figure that out. But, yeah, there is this strange thing where, I think I talked about it in peace. In May of 2013, the president gave this speech at the National Defense University that was really kind of weird and dissociated, because he seemed, not to be speaking as the president, but almost as, you know, a thoughtful critic of presidential warfare, as if he was trapped in a never-ending cycle of war. And like you said, he invoked James Madison's warning that no nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. Meanwhile, he seems, bent on testing that proposition and seeing whether Madison, in fact, was right about that.
Yeah. Well, and, it's the other thing is, too, is it's not just that. It's even on the terror war, is he keeps saying, junior varsity, this and that. Listen, every time a Sunni with a rifle claims he loves Osama somewhere and fires his gun in the air, that doesn't mean we're supposed to fall for it. Right here, he knows better than that, and he keeps saying he knows better than that. And yet, at the same time, in two major cases in Libya and Syria, he actually intervened on the Mujahideen side and has helped, inadvertently or indirectly, to, build them up to where now they've actually declared a whole state, which now he's got to go back to war with. I mean, these are huge own goals if his, own policy really is to try to wind this thing down and to try to, to tell Americans that it doesn't matter if Ansar al-Sharia is running around in Libya or their breakoff is in Mali, that we don't have to go and chase these guys everywhere they run. But now that's exactly what he's done by building them into such a big force in Iraq and Syria.
There's that famous quote from Osama bin Laden about all we have to do is raise the flag of jihad anywhere in the ends of the earth. And I'm paraphrasing here, and the United States will be there in force. Well, we're definitely, playing that out. Obama has seemed at times the reluctant warrior in sort of the way that, former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara seemed the reluctant warrior. But in actual fact, he hasn't been particularly reluctant to go to war. And, there was a piece in PolitiFact a couple weeks ago where they were testing a reporter's claim that Obama had bombed more countries than George W. Bush, and they rated it true. In fact, he had, but they couldn't settle on a precise number because there's this sentence in the piece that both presidents may have bombed the Philippines. We're not sure. And one of the reasons we're not sure is because of the baffling interpretation of the 2001 AUMF, under which the administration feels privileged to keep from the American people the actual list of groups that we're at war with, forces.
If you read Nick Terse about the SOCOM and the Joint Special Operations Command running around Africa, there's no way to know what the real number of countries they've bombed is, but it's a lot more than six or seven.
In fact, when Carl Levin at an Armed Services hearing, Senate Armed Services Committee hearing in 2013, asked the Pentagon personnel, asked the Pentagon spokesman for a list of the associated forces, are we at war with Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, who are the groups on the list? He was told, well, we could maybe give you a list, but you can't share it with anyone, because the explanation later was that it could be a threat to national security, because by letting it be known publicly that some of these groups were on the list, they could build credibility, you know, street cred among other jihadis, and that in itself would bolster their threat to the United States. So you've got a situation where, you know, they talk about secret laws, the secret interpretation of the Patriot Act that we learned about from Edward Snowden. You know, we've essentially got secret wars. We've got an archipelago of secret drone bases being built up in the Middle East and Africa. And we've got a host of groups that were engaged in special forces operations and drone strikes against. And we're not allowed to know who these groups are. You think this would be the core area of debate. You know, if anything is conceded, Madison said that in no part of the Constitution was more wisdom to be found than in the clause that gives the powers of the war and peace to the legislator, not the executive.
Yeah, now that's where we'll have to pick this up on the other side of this break, is on that very point. It's Gene Healy, Vice President at Cato.org. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. Tomorrow, Eric Margolies will be here to talk about some Iraq war history. Stephen Zunis on Israel-Palestine. And on Wednesday, Andrew Coburn will be here. I'm always talking with his brother Patrick about the wars, but Andrew has a new piece all about the A-10 and the B-1 and the military-industrial complex and the economics of politics, as Anakin Skywalker calls it. Oh, wait. No, I guess that was Obi-Wan Kenobi. No, it was Anakin. Anyway, this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Gene Healy, and so the economics of the politics of constitutional war powers. That's where we left off this conversation, and I really like the way you go through it in the article and really explain. We have plenty of time for you to explain just how bad these guys are at trying to make up their excuses for going around the Constitution the way they do. America goes to war and Congress goes on an early summer vacation to just let the president decide. The president who's at his lowest approval rating ever. The president that nobody considers to represent them any longer, very few. And yet the Congress just says, hey, go ahead. Under what all theories? Because there are a few. Gene, could you please explain?
Sure. What Obama wants to avoid, because he's not George W. Bush, supposedly, he wants to avoid the outright deciderist theory, the John Yoo-style theory, where these decisions are for the president alone to make as a matter of inherent executive power. You know, ironically, even though Bush maintained that he was not required to get congressional authorization, he got congressional authorization for both major wars of the Bush administration. But Obama doesn't want to be seen to be advancing a constitutional theory under which essentially, I can do whatever I want. But what he does, I think, is in many ways more embarrassing. You know, give John Yoo the credit for, saying openly, I believe that the Constitution means the president has the right to start wars whenever he thinks it's a good idea. Obama's never going to cop to that charge. So instead, he and his administration go on a search for authorizations from past Congresses, and they take old AUMFs, old authorizations for the use of military force, specifically the 2001 authorization passed 3 days after September 11th. And they're also keeping alive the 2002 Iraq War Resolution for the current fight against ISIS. And they really have to waterboard these authorizations to get to torture any kind of argument for a new war out of them. In the case of the 2002 Iraq War Resolution, the thing is titled Authorization for the Use of Military Force Against Iraq. The preamble to the resolution is full of, as you expect, references to Saddam Hussein, weapons of mass destruction, and UN Security Council resolutions. The operative clause of that resolution is about the continuing threat posed by Iraq, i.e. the Iraqi government. Well, the Iraqi government, the new Iraqi government, the Shiite-led ramshackle government that we helped set up, is part of our coalition of the willing in this operation against ISIS. It's not a war against Iraq. It's a war in Iraq and Syria against a different enemy, 11 years or so after the war against Saddam Hussein. And they're really relying a lot on the 2001 AUMF, which the further you get away from September 11th, the worse that language seems to fit anybody that we're fighting now, particularly ISIS. One of their major problems with trying to shoehorn ISIS into the 2001 AUMF is that the language of that resolution is aimed at the perpetrators of 9/11 and anyone who harbored them. Well, they've been excommunicated by core al-Qaeda. They're not harboring them. Many of them are too young to have been involved in any way, shape, or form with September 11th. But the administration is, you kind of have to tease this out. The longest statement we have of their legal theory is by an unidentified, unnamed senior administration official who told the New York Times that, paraphrasing again here, but something to the effect that because a lot of people in the broader world of jihadism think that ISIS is the legitimate heir to Osama bin Laden's legacy, and because we think they represent a threat, we have all the authority we need for a new war 12 some years later against a group that didn't exist on September 11th. It's really quite a stretch, and you wonder what the would it be any worse? It might actually be better if they owned up to their actual legal theory, which is we can do what we want when we think there's a threat to U.S. national security or to our political viability.
Right. Well, and back to what Obama pretends some of the time about how, no, we're not at war with any Sunni with a rifle. That basically is the real policy. Anytime you got a Sunni with a rifle somewhere, we can go bomb. Now, I don't know if they could extend this as far as bombing Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, who are Shia and who are pro-Iran and who are sworn enemies of al-Qaeda or not. But certainly, if a jihadi goes from where Obama backed him in Libya on over into Mali and hijacks the poor Tuaregs rebellion there, then that's fine. He can intervene against them, I guess. And I mean, in that case, they did send special forces and help the French in limited ways with their invasion of the South, at least. So,
yeah.
The news, Gene.
Yeah, they've essentially turned the 2001 AUMF into a permanent delegation of war powers to the president, and the Pentagon has said quite openly that we see this going on for 10 to 20 more years. Like I said in the piece, that means this could be the basis for President Chelsea Clinton's kill list in 2033. You've got a legal theory that's completely divorced from the actual language of the authorization, and one that they're telling us will be operative for now till up to 20 years.
Yeah, and
underlying it all, a refusal to admit that anything that they've done really has led us to this place. I mean, the closest you could get to that is some Democrats defending Obama by saying, nuh-uh, it's Bush's fault in a partisan way. But you do not have the national security state or the news really in general saying, now, what have we learned about how we got here and how might we be careful about how we do this right this time at least, right? You don't even have any reflection at all because nobody can admit it because they're all guilty as hell of the same damn idiocy that got us into this mess. And so it just go right on like history began on June the 4th or 5th.
So he may have ended up with the Democratic nomination in 2008 because he wasn't in the Senate to vote for the Iraq War, and because as a state senator, he made that speech against quote-unquote dumb wars like Iraq. Well, his legacy with these expanded, boundless interpretations of past authorizations for the use of military force, his legacy is essentially creating a legal theory that allows him and future presidents to fight as many dumb wars as they like.
Right. Yeah. Well, and they just keep doing it. And as you say here, yeah, quoting Lang, the self-licking ice cream cone. I won't ruin the article's punchline. Everyone go read it. The Forever War President, Obama's Transformational War Powers Legacy. But yeah, they can just keep creating enemies ad infinitum. And again, even as the president himself admits that, that's how we got here to a certain degree. He concedes it. He just keeps right on. And so, I don't know what else to say.
It's a heck of a mess. Yeah.
Well, you know what? Back to the legality for a second. And we got about, I don't know. I forget if it's a half a minute or a minute and a half here, Gene, for you to comment. But back to the point about the lawlessness of the declaration of war. That really just goes to the overall major problem of empire and the lawlessness of the government in general. If they can lawlessly get us into a major war, they can pretty much do whatever the hell they want. What can't they do if they can do this? Which everything else is less than this.
You mentioned Congress heading out of town, and it made me think of Speaker Boehner, who says, this shouldn't be done by a lame duck Congress. We may need ground troops, but let's not be in a hurry to vote about it. Meanwhile, the same Speaker Boehner who sees unprecedented lawlessness in Obama, delaying the imposition of the employer mandate and is suing the president for not implementing portions of a law that the GOP views as socialism, he thinks that this is the end of the republic, but we're in no hurry to vote on the most important thing that the Constitution gives the Congress responsibility for, war and peace. It's a pretty sad situation.
Yeah, that's what Chalmers Johnson named his third book there in the trilogy, Nemesis. It's republic or empire, but it just can't be both, and we're living it every day, I'll tell you. Well, thanks very much, Gene, for your time. It's great to have you back on the
show. Thanks, Scott.
All right, so that's Gene Healy. He's vice president of the Cato Institute. Thank goodness for that. The Cult of the Presidency, America's Dangerous Devotion to Executive Power, is his latest at Cato.org, and it's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. Thanks very much, y'all, for listening. We're all over time and got to go. See y'all tomorrow.